There's a matrix, which is the form of the ritual, but embedded in that matrix are consciousness-altering techniques. So it is not merely a ritual. The main action of the ritual involves three things. One's body is involved in making ritual gestures that are both symbolic but also have a certain impact on consciousness because of the way that they feel as you make them. The speech mechanism is engaged in chanting mantras, which change throughout the ritual. Different mantras for different aspects, different hand gestures, which are called mudras, for different aspects of the ceremony. And one's mental faculty is involved in the act of, quote, visualization. I say, quote, visualization because what we're really talking about is mental creation, creating from scratch an alternate reality. Now, it's true, it's mostly seen, but it can also be heard and felt and smelled, the whole thing. It is literally creating out of nothing something. What are created are the visualized archetypes, the deities, the gods, the ancestors, the guardians, the demons. You might well ask, what could all of this possibly have to do with the Buddha's original teachings? This seems like the very antithesis of his teachings. Yet, it is in fact a path to the same enlightened consciousness. At the expense of gross oversimplification, let me give you the quick and dirty of it. Clearly, if you engage your hands in a sequence of elegant gestures and your speech in a sequence of repetitive mantras and your mind in the creation of vivid images, you are going to develop a lot of concentration. It's an expedient means, an upaya, to get people into real concentrated states, as is, in fact, just about any ceremony. People nowadays mostly hate ceremonies and rituals. That's because they don't get into them. But if you really get into a ceremony, you'll find that it is a context within which it is relatively easy to become very focused because everything's real simplified. And if your ceremony happens to be so engaging of all three fundamental parts of the human, the body, the speech, and the mind, simultaneously, dance is very focusing. Gestures are very focusing to the body. Mantra is very focusing because repeating the sounds over and over again cuts against the grain of the internal dialogue. Feeling the vibrations in your body gives you a feedback loop as you go deeper into meditation. Your body resonates more deeply. There's a lot of reasons why mantra builds concentration. There's a lot of reasons why chanting is used all over the world. And visualizing, trying to create and hold a vivid image stable in front of you, builds a lot of concentration. So if nothing else, doing these rituals develops samadhi. It develops that common thread that I mentioned goes through all the mystical traditions of the world. But of course, according to Buddhism, if you only develop samadhi, concentration, that's not enough. You have to use concentration to go beyond the concentrated mind. So how in this Vajrayana practice does one go beyond the concentrated mind? Once again, this is a gross simplification, but remember the Zen master that says when you see the flower, how do you experience your spiritual source? And the answer is to become the flower, merge with the flower, have samadhi with the flower. Well, at the core of the Vajrayana ritual, the visualized deity is merged with. You experience yourself becoming that deity. Merge with in exactly the same way that a Zen person would merge with a flower or a teacup, or for that matter, that you merge with another human being. Exactly the same way. All the awareness goes into the image. None of the awareness is back on your own image, who you are. So you get a sense that you are that visualized archetype. And you get insight into the arbitrary nature of self-identification. You created something from nothing, from scratch, and then you replaced your own image of who you are with it, and lo and behold, you feel like you are that. Well, clearly, this is going to give you a new relationship to your ordinary image of who you are. You realize the arbitrary nature of the identification process. In Zen, you realize that you can be a flower, or you can be anybody you talk to, or you can be the whole universe. In Vajrayana, you realize that too, but you also realize that you can become a god or a demon. You can become a myth. You can become an archetype just as well. No difference in the basic process. Now, of course, according to Mahayana Buddhism, it's not enough just to become free from one's limited identity by realizing the arbitrary nature of the identification process. One has to serve. One has to serve one's fellow beings. How is that achieved in Vajrayana? Well, through many, many, many ways. But once again, at the expense of gross simplification, consider the following. In these cultures, the Buddha is an archetype. The Buddha is a spiritual image charged with energy. Very different from early Buddhism. There were no images of the Buddha originally. For hundreds of years, he was never portrayed, certainly not portrayed as some idealized demigod. But by the time Mahayana rolls around, Buddha's getting deified. And by the time Vajrayana rolls around, they decided to make use of that fact and just acknowledge it and incorporate it into the practice. If you experience yourself as the archetype of spiritual perfection, then in a very real sense, you instantly become a Buddha. You look back and you say, what am I? I am that image of my perfection. And looking back and experiencing yourself that way has a profound effect, purifying effect on your consciousness. You are going around literally as the Buddha. It's not like acting. It's like being. But furthermore, what about the people around you? Well, at some subtle level, they're impacted by this image that you carry around of yourself. You're functioning among them, in some ways radiating at a subtle archetypical level the impact of that image within that culture. That's the power of visualization to influence the people around you and to in some way reach out to them. Upaya, skillful means, also means ways of reaching out, not just techniques to get to a goal. It bothers me to have to so grossly oversimplify the Buddhist tradition. I've left out a whole lot of schools, Nichiren, Pure Land. But in broad outline, this is the big picture of Buddhism. Three historical periods in India, in the modern times, impacting in three geographical regions of Asia, and with three typical practices. I sometimes compare the three approaches, Vipassana, Zen, and Vajrayana, to three kinds of artistic sentiment. It's really in some ways a judgment call, which of these approaches most appeals to a person. Of course, they all have what I call the party line. the claims of why they are the true, the original, the pure, the only, the fastest, the best, etc., etc. I've heard all the party lines, and I've heard all of the arguments against the party lines. Even within the Vipassana tradition, there are lineages. There's the Ubakin lineage, there's the Mahasi Sayadaw lineage, those are the two major ones. The approach you got here had elements of both of those lineages, actually. And each of those lineages has its party line, why it's the best, the true, the original, the only, etc., etc. What I tell people, every spiritual path, every teacher, every organization, every spiritual process has two things. It's got something that's going to provide you with true nourishment, and it's got a hook. Learn how to nibble the bait without getting the hook, is my advice to people in general, including with Vipassana. In some ways, it is a little bit of a judgment call. It's a matter of taste. Which of these three approaches, if any, you would like for yourself. So I compare the three approaches to three styles of art. Vajrayana is like European Baroque or Rococo or High Renaissance. Very elaborate, very rich, very colorful. Zen is sort of like Sung Dynasty landscape painting. Mostly monochrome, but some splashes of color. And Vipassana is like what they call California minimalist. Three shades of gray on a wall. It's real bleak in a sense. It's almost minimal art. But there are certain advantages to that minimal case. The cultural baggage is considerably less. And the techniques, although they may lack the poetry of Zen or the richness of Vajrayana, the techniques of Vipassana have the advantage of being very straightforward. They're prosaic. They're like a carefully crafted essay. They're like a computer algorithm. Most people can do them, but they're prosaic. But they do get the job done. This will give you some idea of the range within Buddhism. But as I mentioned, Buddhism is only part of the big picture. And I'd like now to talk about an even wider perspective, which incorporates Buddhism as a subset. As I've mentioned throughout this series, the kinds of experiences that a person has over years and decades of practicing one of the Buddhist traditions are closely related to experiences that exist outside of Buddhism. I've talked about how the samadhi of Buddhism is related to the prayer of quiet that is part of traditional Christianity. I've talked about some of the similarities between the Jewish Kabbalistic perception of how creation comes about and that which is found in some schools of Buddhism. In Hinduism, there is a tendency to describe enlightenment as realizing one's true self. On the other hand, in Buddhism, there's a tendency to describe enlightenment as realizing that one truly has no self. The vocabulary might lead one to believe that these are two completely different experiences, maybe the opposite experience. But in point of fact, they really talk about the same experience. Why is it that they have such different vocabulary? Because the words are being used differently. When one starts to observe the thoughts and feelings that produce the sense of self, as one penetrates deeper and deeper and deeper into that direction, eventually one comes to the end of the thoughts and feelings that produce the sense of an individual self. and one links to something larger. Depending on how one might choose to use words, one can say that that something larger is no self, because you've come to the end of the thoughts and feelings that produce your individual sense of self, and what lies just beyond that, the source, the formless activity, is not those individual thoughts and feelings. So in Buddhism, they say that's no self. You've gone beyond the self. On the other hand, you might say that because the sense of self is at the core of your being, and that was the direction that you took, and you penetrated further and further and further in that direction into the core, one might say that what you eventually contact there is the final piece of that direction. And since you started with the individual self, you might say that what you reach through augering through the individual self is your true self. Because that's the direction, self. In other words, core. In other words, into the substance of your being. Because of that, they use different words for related experiences, and it's very confusing. In the Islamic tradition, I mentioned how they have concentrative practices, zikr they call it, and how one experiences oneness, first merging with one's teacher, and then merging with the spiritual source. The technical term for that in Arabic is fana, passing away of one's individual existence for a period of time. The Taoist tradition is very interesting because the early Taoist, Laozi and Zhuangzi, spoke of a kind of oneness with the universe that they called Tao. And of course, they spoke of the Tao as having yin and yang, consisting of yin and yang, the expansive and contractive, the affirming and negating activities. That clearly links with the same worldwide tradition. Later on in Taoism, they developed techniques of meditation that involved harnessing the flow of qi. And as I mentioned in one of the talks, the Chinese concept of qi or energy is very related to the Buddhist experience of anicca or impermanence. Their meditation techniques involved initially paying close attention to how the energies flow in the body through the meridians, and then by generalizing that, linking to the energy flow of the whole universe. All over the world, we can see that most of the major spiritual traditions have what we might refer to as a mystical core, which links to the kinds of experience that people have in Buddhism, even though there may not be any historical links. There is, in other words, a kind of universal experience that is open to all human beings. I also mentioned how this kind of experience can happen to people outside of spiritual traditions, within a completely secular context, just through practicing an art of some sort. One thing that I haven't mentioned yet is that enlightened experience can happen without cultivation. Almost everything that I've talked about so far involved cultivation, an intention to practice concentrative techniques, and then to use that concentration as a tool to, in some way, go beyond a mere state of concentration to a transformation of consciousness, a change in one's identity. It sometimes happens, though, that people just spontaneously fall into an enlightenment experience. And in fact, most people, sometime in their life, whether they're aware of it or not, come very close to this kind of experience. But some people do more than come close. They just spontaneously, without any particular preparation or cultivation, fall into a state like this. Now, typically what happens is that it wears off, maybe after a few minutes, maybe after a few hours, maybe after a few weeks. Why does it wear off? Because they don't have a momentum of concentration power to hold that experience when it happens. And they may also lack a conceptual framework against which to understand what is happening to them. They may have had no study of any spiritual path whatsoever. One description I once heard of a woman with very little education, older woman, the way she described it is, one day, suddenly, I was just big. And that's all she could understand about it. That's all she could say about it. Typically, it does fade, although there are also examples of people that have spontaneously fallen into this, and it didn't fade. They just lived the rest of their life that way. I think that was the case of the woman that said, suddenly one day I was just big. She fell into it, and it didn't fade. A friend of mine had an experience like this when she was in college, and it didn't fade for her. And she spent years and years trying to find another human being on this planet who could understand what she had experienced. Her name is Flora Courtois. She wrote a book about this, actually, called An Enlightenment Experience, later on in life. She went to her priest, didn't have a clue. Went to the school psychologist, didn't have a clue. Years passed, she thought she was the only one. And then she started to read books on Zen, and she met some Zen masters and understood she was not the only one. There's a whole tradition of it all over the world, a whole methodology. Even if it doesn't fade, like in the case of my friend Flora, it took her many years before she could really reach the fullness of the potential of her enlightenment was, because she didn't know the role of concentration. She didn't know the facets of enlightenment that I've been speaking about, how to proceed. Without some background, when these things happen spontaneously, they tend to fade, and even if they don't fade, it's difficult to realize their full potential. But I say enlightenment is just like a window opening. It's a crack. And typically after the first opening, it takes years and years and years to get that window to open panoramically on all sides. So we have enlightened consciousness that is found inside the core of each spiritual tradition. We have enlightened consciousness that is found outside of spiritual traditions, that comes about through certain concentrative activities, sports, the arts. We have enlightened consciousness that comes about without any particular cultivation, just happens to people. Sometimes they are able to hold it, sometimes they're not. Of course, if a person has a background, if a person has developed high states of concentration, if they have a spontaneous experience like that, they will hold it, they will not lose it, and it will not be a peak experience. It will be their abiding reality. And in point of fact, peak experience does not count as enlightenment. Anything that you come down from doesn't count. Only permanent and radical change in perspective. You're just never the same afterwards. Only that counts as an enlightenment experience. So we see it all over the world. As I mentioned, it existed also in the Western tradition in ancient Greece. Indeed, each of the major schools of Greek philosophy has in it some facet of enlightenment, although I don't think that most of the expositors of Greek philosophy, even the great names, were, quote, enlightened in the Buddhist sense. But it's amazing how relevant the things that they say are from an enlightened perspective. It's almost like you get the sense that that civilization was moving in that direction but couldn't quite get there. But boy, they sure had some important insights. I think the reason that they couldn't quite get there is that they didn't have the sense of methodical cultivation. It's India that developed that, the idea that there are postures, that there are procedures, there are literally algorithms, there are exercises that people could put themselves through and have a high probability of having these experiences. In the West, even in the pre-Christian West, I think it was looked upon as a much more haphazard kind of process. We have the major spiritual traditions of the world. We have secular enlightenment. We have spontaneous enlightenment. And we have some examples of enlightenment in European classical antiquity. And we also have thought in that time, philosophical thought of the ancient Greeks, oriented towards the fundamental issues involved in enlightenment, even if it didn't quite make it there. But there's one major aspect of human history and human culture that we haven't mentioned. And it's so easy to forget, but it is absolutely fundamental to any understanding of the bigger picture. So what hasn't been mentioned? We've mentioned pre-Christian Europe, we've mentioned the major Western religions, the major Eastern religions, the secular, the spontaneous. What hasn't been mentioned? What has not been mentioned is what, in fact, constitutes the bulk of human history. And that is the tribal world. Shamans. And I think a very good case could be made that the whole meditative tradition begins there. And in fact, there was a time when there was hardly any difference between meditating and just living life. And as so-called civilization progressed, just living life didn't put one in a meditative state. And so it was necessary to develop actual technologies and techniques in order to meditate. So from that perspective, meditation is actually the tip of the iceberg. And the bulk of the spiritual history of this planet is the centuries and millennia before there ever was a need to meditate. If you think about what life must have been like at an early period, let's say in the Paleolithic, the Old Stone Age, it occurs to me that based on what we see in modern tribal peoples, that life would have had three characteristics. It would have been very simple, more or less do the same routine every day, not a whole lot to agitate your mind, not a whole lot to plan or fantasize about. Life was simple. Life was uncomfortable relative to the way we live now or the way many people live now. Life would have been very uncomfortable, very inconvenient. With central heating, it's still pretty tough to live in Minnesota. How did people do it with teepees and buckskin? It was tough. There were many, many physical demands on people. If you got sick, wasn't the hospital. If She got injured. There weren't paramedics. There was a lot of discomfort. You slept on the ground, and you were subject to fatigue, to hot, to cold, to bugs, all sorts of stuff. Life was uncomfortable. That's the second characteristic. Third characteristic, life was full of things you couldn't understand. Pre-scientific times, life was full of mystery. What's an eclipse? What does it mean? Why are things the way they are? What's lightning? What's the sun? Life was full of imponderables, of mysteries. When life is simple, and life is uncomfortable, and life is full of things you can't understand. There's a word in Sioux, waka, it means sacred, but it also means that which can't be understood, the mystery. Great Spirit is really the great mystery. If life has these three characteristics, then there are two directions to go from there. One direction is figure out more and more stuff. Life's full of things you can't understand. Figure them out. Related to that direction, you're uncomfortable. Figure out ways to get comfortable. Figure out how to build more comfortable dwellings, how to make more comfortable clothes, how to control the world around you, how to make better weapons to protect you from the beasts and whatever. One direction you can go from life being uncomfortable and full of mysteries is make yourself comfortable and figure out the mysteries. This is what we call the evolution of civilization. Over the centuries, over the millennia, this is what the human species did. That reaches, of course, its culmination in the scientific revolution and in the industrial revolution. And we now, those of us that live in the fortunate parts of the world that have benefited most from this process of civilization, we now have lives that are pretty comfortable, and we now know a lot of things. We've figured out a lot of stuff. Of course, in the process, life ceased to be simple and became extremely complex. So our present situation is, not for everyone on this planet, certainly, but for people in the industrial countries, life's comfortable. We understand a lot of real fundamental stuff that no one understood before, and life's very complex. This is one direction that people can take, starting in the Paleolithic. In a sense, it's wonderful how much we now know and how much we can now do to make ourselves comfortable. I would never say that this is a bad thing. However, we have paid a price, haven't we, for this. There is, of course, another direction, another response to the situation of early times, tribal times. Life's uncomfortable, so you learn to have equanimity with discomfort. Life's full of mystery, so you learn how to surrender to the mystery and give up the need to understand. You sacramentalize the mystery. And you ceremonialize the discomfort. Life's simple. Upon occasion, you make it even simpler by doing a ceremony. What is a ceremony? A ceremony is a vast simplification of ordinary life. Everything is predictable. Everything is repetitive. Everything is simple in a ceremony. So in the tribal situation, You do ceremonies. Ceremonies represent a going in the other direction from civilization. Civilization pushes forward towards understanding more, getting more comfortable, getting more complex. Ceremony pushes backwards. It's contractive. Civilization is expansive. That's good. Ceremonies are contractive. That's good, too. So in a ceremony, you typically, in the tribal situation, make a sacrifice. Life's uncomfortable, and the ceremonies are even more uncomfortable. That's exemplified in this Western Hemisphere by things like the sweat lodge, the sun dance, the vision quest. These are the typical ceremonial practices of Native North America. They involve exposing oneself voluntarily to discomfort. Sweat lodge is hot. Sundance, you have to go without food or water for 4 days. And in some tribes, you have to be pierced. You have to have literally the flesh torn from your body to sacrifice. It's uncomfortable. But within the ceremonial context, you have equanimity with it. And after 4 days without food or water, you start to give up the need to know or understand. And you're listening to songs and singing, and there's drumming over and over and over again. Well, a person from a civilization, their minds are so complex that they can listen to singing and drumming for day after day, and their mind is still spinning. But somebody that comes from a simple culture, after they listen to the drum for a little while, they just become that. Their mind goes into samadhi more or less easily. The simplified ceremonial context, the music, which readily develops a state of concentration for that culture. What do we have here? We have here the elements of meditation. Equanimity with the discomfort. Equanimity with the need to know, surrendering to the mystery. Entering states of high concentration through the simplicity of the ceremony, through the physical impact of the sacrifice, through the repetitive sounds of the drum and the music. We so-called civilized people have very little appreciation of what ceremony is really about for tribal people. And we can only surmise that this is what it was like in ancient times. And this is, in fact, probably what it was like for most of human history. So people punctuated the cycle of their life with these ceremonies that actually looked back instead of forward. They looked back to greater simplicity. And they took one back to what is behind, what is back. Back means go back to the spiritual source of all things. And then, when you encounter discomforts in daily life, when you encounter mysteries in daily life, you start to relate to it the same way you related to it in the ceremony. And all of life becomes sacramentalized. It's just one giant meditation. I'm not so naive as to ascribe to the noble savage theory that every tribal person was enlightened or even remotely like that, but the culture would have oriented people in a very natural way to these kinds of experiences, and I suspect a significant number of people lived in states of extremely high concentration, and a significant number of people had enlightenment experiences either in the ceremonial context or just in day-to-day life. I have an American Indian friend who does a lot of these things. He's a veteran sun dancer and pipe carrier. We know each other pretty well, and we can talk about just about anything. So I once asked him to tell me his most significant spiritual experiences that he had had. And he said, it was the first sweat lodge that I ever did. There was one year when I sun danced, and after the dance, I had a kind of spiritual high that lasted like for the whole year. And then there was the time I was out hunting. I got lost for several days without food or water. I thought I was going to die. That was pretty good, too. And of course, that last one, what was that? That was like what most people would call like a horrible catastrophe, right? Of course, what he meant was, it wasn't all that different from the Sundance. He'd already learned to sacramentalize the situation of not having food and water, of being in fear and in pain and confusion. In the ceremonial context, that had already become a sacred purifier to him. So when something like that happened in daily life, it was like that was one of his peak spiritual experiences. It was not a bad thing. Eventually he was rescued. So we can well imagine the situation of early humanity as being something like this. On one hand, from that starting place, one can expand, figure out more things, get more comfortable, and get more complex. And lo and behold, that's where we end up now, so-called civilization. Or one can contract, have equanimity with discomfort, thereby purifying the feeling core of our being. Have equanimity with the confusions and the things you can't figure out, the numinous, the mysterious, and therefore work through the need to know, which purifies the conceptual part of our being. That will take one back to the spiritual source. Looked at in the broad picture of things, the big picture, it seems to me that we human beings have two legitimate directions to pursue. One of them is exemplified by science, which shows us how to understand things in deeper and deeper ways, and how to manipulate the world. The other is exemplified by spirituality, but core spirituality is really enlightenment. There's a lot of things peripheral to spirituality, but at the core of spirituality is enlightenment, as I've been trying to describe it. And because we don't live in a tribal situation anymore, where enlightenment can happen just as part of life, the most likely way to come to enlightenment is through a systematic meditation practice. It seems to me that if we look at the really big picture, the really broad sweep of human history, across the centuries and millennia, across the different races and cultures, two disciplines stand out as globally significant. The first discipline got its start in ancient Greece, went through a hiatus of over 1,000 years, and then got started up again in the Renaissance in Europe. And that is Western science. The second discipline, although it is found all over the world, meditation, is most systematically cultivated in the cultures influenced by India, and specifically within Buddhism. So if I had to take the broadest view of what we as human beings have achieved in the millennia of our existence here, since tribal time, I would say that the two most important and impressive things that I know of are the external technology of Western science and the internal technology of Eastern meditation. Now, in speaking of the history of science, there is a theme which comes up over and over again. And that is the theme of branches of science cross-fertilizing each other, or more broadly, disciplines cross-fertilizing each other. The classic example comes in the area of mathematics. Up until the 16th century, there were two parts to mathematics. One was geometry, which is the study of space, and the other was algebra, which is the study of numbers, and then a little further on, the study of the abstract operations and structures of things like numbers. Mathematicians for centuries had developed geometry as a discipline and arithmetic and algebra as another discipline. And they were pretty separate in their development. And each had a profound body of knowledge associated with it. After all, space is one thing and numbers are something seemingly quite different. Then along came a man named René Descartes. Now Descartes is probably most remembered in the popular mind for the famous Cartesian dictum, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Of course, from the viewpoint of any meditator who has experienced long periods of time without thought, that's a rather strange statement. Personally, I don't consider that statement to be of very much significance. However, Descartes did achieve something of really monumental significance, which is, he saw a natural relationship between geometry and algebra. He realized that certain types of equations could be represented as geometrical figures, and that points in space could be described in terms of pairs or triples of numbers. If it's a two-dimensional space, you need two numbers. If it's a three-dimensional space, you need three numbers to represent a point, and we call those numbers coordinates or Cartesian coordinates. And the grid that he created, either two or three-dimensional, we call a Cartesian coordinate grid or Cartesian axes. So he showed a natural relationship between algebraic equations and geometrical figures in Euclidean space. Specifically, he showed a relationship between what are called conic sections and what are called quadratic equations. This cross-fertilization, this union of the two fundamental branches of mathematics, paved the way for the development of an entirely new kind of mathematics, absolutely unlike either algebra or geometry, a third branch of mathematics that was developed by Newton and Leibniz and is nowadays called analysis, but the first development in this field of analysis is the subject that is called calculus. Calculus is quite a different critter. It's its own thing. So here you have two branches of a science with long independent development suddenly being brought together, and out of that cross-fertilization, a whole new direction in mathematics grows and turns out to be something immensely powerful, totally unlike anything that had existed before, and leads to many, many future developments. So there's a classic example of two branches coming together. Now, what I have to ask myself is, given the big, big picture, that it seems that we human beings have developed two fundamental technologies as human beings. One is Western science, the whole thing, and the other is the meditative science. I have to ask myself, is there a natural cross-fertilization? Is there a relationship? If so, what is the nature of the relationship? And what kinds of things might come out of a bringing together of these two worlds? Science is a passionate interest of mine, but it wasn't always that way. In fact, my initial experiences with science and mathematics were extremely negative. That's why I can really appreciate how people have phobias and even complexes in these areas, because that was certainly true in my case. I basically failed all of my math and science classes, starting in high school and continuing through college. In fact, the one flat-out F that I got at UCLA when I was an undergraduate was also the one actual science course that I attempted to take, which was beginning astronomy. And when I had been in high school and was failing elementary geometry and elementary algebra, this was a source of a lot of emotional turmoil in our family, because my dad was really good at mathematics, and they couldn't understand why I just couldn't get decent grades. And there was a lot of crying and a lot of yelling and a lot of carrying on. So it's not only that I had this intellectual conviction and inferiority complex about myself conceptually, but also there was a lot of emotional charge to this subject, a lot of pain associated with my inability to perform in these areas. Well, anyway, I eventually went to Japan, became a Buddhist monk, practiced Buddhist meditation for a number of years. And as I mentioned in an earlier talk, I became friends with a Roman Catholic priest named Father William Johnson, who has written many books since then. And as I mentioned, I owe to him a lot because he broadened my perspective, allowed me to understand that Buddhist meditation was merely a subset of a much larger worldwide phenomenon. But in point of fact, he broadened my perspective far wider than just that. Just before I left Japan, he came up to me and he was like all excited. He said, "Look at this, isn't this exciting?" Of course, you know, the Jesuits are the great intellectuals of the Roman Catholic Church, so things that were intellectually significant fascinated him. He said, "Look at this, isn't this exciting? Isn't this exciting?" And what he had was an article about scientists that were doing research on the brainwaves of meditators. And he says, "Isn't this the greatest thing? These scientists are using objective criteria to validate the subjective spiritual reports of, in this case, Zen meditators." He said that he knew some guys in Japan that were doing this research. And we went and we actually had our brainwaves measured and everything, and it was absolutely fascinating. Of course, the people that were doing the research were themselves Buddhists. They were surprised that a Roman Catholic priest had the same kinds of brainwaves as a veteran Zen meditator. But of course, there's nothing surprising about that at all. Samadhi is samadhi, whatever your theology may be. Well, I thought this was pretty interesting. And it seemed to bring together two worlds that you wouldn't think had anything to do with each other. Science on one hand, and meditation and spirituality on the other. So I thought, well, I'm going back to the States. Maybe I should learn a little bit about this brainwave research stuff, and maybe I'll learn a little about science and I can overcome some of these gaps in my development and my phobias and my past conditionings and things like that. When I came back to the States, I called up my friend Dr. Thich Thien Anh, who is a Vietnamese Buddhist monk with whom I had studied Vietnamese when I was at UCLA. Turns out he had, in the intervening years while I was away in Japan, he had built up a whole center and was running retreats and had a whole temple and everything. So he invited me to come to a meditation retreat, which I did. And during the retreat, I had an occasion to talk to him, and I said, you know, before I left Japan, I found out that they're starting to do research on the brainwaves of us while we meditate. And he said, oh, yeah, I know all about that. In fact, we have two of the researchers here at the retreat. And I'll introduce you. So I wasn't back in the States but 2 weeks, and I was already meeting three major researchers in the field of brainwave biofeedback on meditators. That was Lester Femi, Ed Wartz, and David Nolis, all well-known in this field. After the retreat was over, the next day, they invited me to come to their lab and get all hooked up. That began an interest in learning about science, because it made science relevant to something that was very important for me. And it's very interesting. The effects of all of those years of meditating had profoundly changed me in terms of my abilities to learn things and the way that I learned things. First of all, of course, I had vastly greater concentration power than I had had as a young person. When I'd read a book on mathematics or science and I didn't understand it, I could come back and read it again and read it again. I wouldn't give up as easily. My focus was much greater. That helped a lot. But there were some other things about the meditation that helped me learn science this second time around as an adult. One was, of course, the memories came up, the beliefs about myself, the memories of my track record. And with those memories came up feelings. And I could use the meditation to observe my beliefs. I'll never be able to do this. I've never been able to do this. With equanimity, not buying into them, but not trying to suppress them either, just letting them come and go. And I could use the meditation to watch the feelings that came up. Because when I'd read something and I couldn't understand it, it would evoke all those feelings from childhood. And I would observe them in the ways that I've described in this series. So it helped a lot in that area too, because eventually the thoughts didn't come up so much and the feelings sort of broke up into energy and didn't get in the way so much. This ability to concentrate better, this ability to disabuse myself of the convictions and judgments about myself and deal with the feelings because of past failures allowed me to get pretty good in these areas, good enough eventually to teach in college these subjects. It's 100% a function of the meditation process. Over the years, I've had occasion to ponder the nature of the relationship between what I call the external science of the West and the internal science of the East. The Science of Enlightenment, Session 24, on the Big Picture, Part 4, More on Science, Spirituality, and the Future of Humanity. There are some things that we need to be careful of when we bring these two domains together. The first is in the area of prejudice. Many scientists would look upon meditators specifically and spiritual people in general as being sort of superstitious, obscurantist, airhead types, credulous, naive, not really worthy of entering into serious discussion with. On the other hand, people on the spiritual path have often had the kind of negative experience with science that I did when I was young. There's a certain phobia involved, and also a certain association of technology with the abuses of technology. Science tends to be looked upon as something bad or dangerous by spiritual people.